When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
This week's episode of Motherfuck Lore is brought to you by the show's generous supporters on Patreon. Supporters like Gabriel Beecham. Mil buicas, Gabriel. Listeners who support the show on Patreon get access to a range of bonus content, including bonus episodes, blooper reels, access to our Discord server where you can chat with other fans about episodes, and much more. Check it out at patreon.com/Derek. And now the show. From the Headstuff Podcast Network, welcome to Motherfuck Lore, a podcast of words, Irish words, and words from Ireland. I am Derek O'Shea.
And I am Patrick O'Vonnie. Did we have to leave that gap in after the I? Was that a
yes.
Was that a thing? That's a thing we're doing this week.
It's a thing now. Apparently that little gap is, you know, it makes people, you know, relax. They know what's going on.
It put me on tenterhooks. It put me on edge. It was the opposite effect with me. I was, what's he going to say? Oh, he's Derek O'Shea. Yeah, no, I knew that.
This could go anywhere, you know. Who knows? Dramatic pauses. It's what it's all about. Patter, how are you getting on? You staying well?
Yeah, staying well, keeping well. Mm-hmm. Trying to anyway. Sure, like, I mean, every week we do this. Like, how are you getting on? What's going on? My life has not changed since last week. I have the same 4 walls and the same 5 kilometers. And to be honest with you, I'm lucky, I'm happy, I'm healthy. So, you know, I'm looking after myself. Yeah, it's good. It's good.
Yes, I'm constantly reminded of Oscar Wilde's line about the wallpaper.
I mean, you're not on your deathbed. You can change the wallpaper if you want. I believe that's an essential purchase.
We've been doing a few episodes recently on place names, and we got some really interesting feedback from our listeners. And if you have a favorite place name or live near somewhere with an interesting place name or have a place name related story, you can send us a voice note on our WhatsApp number. It's in the show notes. In the meantime, have a listen to this.
Hello, it's Misha Ronan, O Dun Padraig, Gondian Dun. I'm a long-time listener of the podcast, and I've really enjoyed your recent series on Loganyam Nyocha, particularly your mountain-themed episode. I'm heavily involved in the subcultures of climbing and mountain running in Ireland, and my home patch is Na Banna Barcha, the Mourns. Every place name tells a story. We have some great Loganyam Nyocha in the Mourns, both in Irish and in English. There's evocative names like Slieve Barna, the Gap Mountain, or the Devil's Bite, as it's locally called, which is beside Polifuca, the Gap of the Puca. There's descriptive names like Lamagan, Slieve Lawagas Glunya, Hands and Knees, Tive Dockra, Tive Jackroch, the Difficult Slope, Slieve Mean, the Smooth Mountain, Ben Crom, the Stooped Mountain. We have Slieve Mille More and Slieve Mille Beg. Confusingly, Slieve Mille Beg is actually taller than Slieve Mille More. And then we have a whole series of mountains named after animals. We've got the Buzzard's Roost, Slieve Na Madi, the Mountain of the Dogs, Tornham Rock, the Tor of the Badgers, Loch Shanna, the Loch of the Foxes. And we've also bizarrely got a mountain called Percy Beech, which I've never understood what the connection is to Percy Beech Shelley. Anyway, that's a snapshot of Loganyam Nyocha in one corner of Ireland. What I love is that there's heritage and stories like this everywhere across the country if you go looking for it. So thank you for shining a light on it. So slán agus gurmaigh.
Thank you so much, Ronan, for that wonderful message. It really is interesting that there's a peak and a granite cave named after Percy Bysshe Shelley, who famously wrote a poem about Mont Blanc, the biggest mountain in the Alps. Before Everest was discovered, Mont Blanc was considered to be the highest mountain in the world. Maybe that has a bearing on a mountain in the Mourne's being named after this particular poet, who didn't have any other association with Ireland, as far as I know. It was a different Percy. In fact, Percy French from French Park, County Roscommon, who made the Mourne's famous internationally in his 1896 song, "This Mountain's a Mourne." It's a beautiful part of the world, and many claim the Bannerburgh inspired local man, C.S. Lewis, to invent the fantasy world of Narnia. This is something that he mentioned, that C.S. Lewis mentioned in his own writings, so it's not just idle speculation. He did frequently write about his love of the countryside of Ulster, and especially the Mourne Mountains. There's a lot up our sleeve when it comes to the stories behind place names. Mila Wiechus wrote on. So, I'm really excited about today's guest.
Yeah, look, we wanted to talk about a specific element of place names that excites me anyway, definitely. I know it excites you as well. And this is sort of remnants of our archaeological history and our cultural heritage. And, of course, Nadini Maha, the good people, the fairy folk, and where we see them in our topographical landscape, I suppose, is the right way to describe it. So we decided to get someone in who knows a lot more about this than the two of us combined. She's a consultant researcher on climate change law with a focus on just transition, but she's also the co-author of an amazing book called Men Who Eat Ring Forts. It's Sinead Mercier. Yay!
Falchka motherfucker, Sinead.
Hello, Gamina Mahagi. It's the Intoch Adventure, Gamahagi.
For some of our listeners are from around the world, from Australia, from Canada, from the United States of America, and they might not be entirely sure what a ring fort is. How would you describe one to someone who maybe wasn't from Ireland and, you know, had seen this written down somewhere but didn't know what it was?
Well, I suppose the kind of thesis in the book is that there's a distinction, there's not quite a distinction, but sometimes a distinction between ring forts and fairy forts. So how ring forts would be commonly understood are kind of Iron Age or even earlier sort of homesteads. So kind of Celtic era or even as far back as the Neolithic in some circumstances, of kind of these mounds in the Irish landscape, which were homesteads. And they are archaeologically significant, I suppose, because they tell us about kind of the way of life then. They're described as ring forts, but kind of subsequent archaeologists have shown that, you know, that kind of term is quite kind of has this idea of this kind of very violent past, but they were mainly just homes. But there's about 30,000 at least in the Irish landscape, if not more. And that's quite rare. Yeah, and quite rare in Western Europe as well, because I suppose Western Europe has been heavily dug for agriculture and kind of very productive sort of intensely farmed landscapes. But they still exist in Ireland. But the interesting thing is that not every ring fort in the Irish landscape is a fairy fort. And sometimes you'll have mounds that are just kind of, or even fairy trees that don't have actually any archaeological significance. They're not recorded anywhere as being, kind of a castle or a fort. They're just kind of a site that has this sort of magical property of the Dini Maha or like kind of fairy lore and fairy legend attaching to them. So that's kind of, not every ring fort is a fairy fort. But there are many kind of fairy forts and fairy trees and holy wells in the Irish landscape.
And this idea that like fairy forts, it's something that has just, it's lasted down generations and generations, centuries, even might be fair to say millennia. You don't tamper with these fairy forts. You don't mess with them. You don't, you don't build on it. You don't take down a fairy tree. You don't break up a stone circle. Is that some kind of inbuilt deference to our ancestors? Or, at some stage, did it become a real belief that the other world has a significant role in society and it's embodied in this geographical feature?
I think it's more The latter. I think that, and the thesis, so I studied heritage law with Tatiana Flessas, who's a wonderful lecturer in the London School of Economics. And during my master's in law, I decided to look at, you know, this kind of really strange occurrence in Irish law where there was kind of new enough legislation trying to protect ferry forts or ring forts, sorry, from being destroyed because we joined the Common Agricultural Policy and agriculture was becoming more intensive. There was more destruction of these sites. But the weird thing was that in all the kind of legal analysis and all the kind of like kind of courtroom descriptions and even from the environmentalists themselves who were trying to protect them, brilliant people, this is no criticism of them, but they never described them as ferry forts. They always called them ring forts, which was quite interesting because everyone under, it's a live belief. You ask, even here, like I had a conversation with a neighbour, I'm in County Clare, and they were like, oh no, I never let the horses near the ferry fort, sure, we'd never go near it. And there's a story of like another family that knocked the ring fort or the ferry fort, and then there was a subsequent kind of, you know, harm brought upon their family. And this is very much a live belief that even with ferry trees and wells as well. But despite all that, and even the Gardaí, so I called up and interviewed Gardaí, and they were like, oh, it was dreadful what that farmer did. He dug up the ferry fort. But like, but when it got to the court, when it got to the law, nobody wanted to mention ferries. It was considered silly or strange or a weird thing to do. But they operate really, really well as a form of environmental protection. And this is the question. I mean, like, what is law? Is like, does law have this conception of itself that it wants to promote more than what it's actually trying to do? Because if the purpose of environmental law is to protect the environment, then why would you not use the dominant kind of pre-enlightenment or sort of the kind of animistic? So animism is this idea that there's a spirituality in natural forms or nature itself, and humans should respect that. But if that exists in the landscape and it's working, why does law still seek to use language that will inevitably destroy them, language that removes that magic or removes that animism? Is it because law is more taken up with this conception of itself as like a tool of rationality, of kind of, you know, purpose of development and capitalist modernity? Or does it have, so that's kind of the thesis of the book. Call them fairy forts, it works.
It's funny because you can imagine. You can imagine, I suppose, an activist or a politician in the early days just trying to put some legislation through, and a legal advisor saying, drop the ferries. They're going to think you're nuts. Even though everyone thinks, you know what, and it also ties in with the whole idea of not mentioning the ferries, you know, referring to them ambiguously as Nadine Mahan or... And,
Or Nadine Pioga, yeah.
The idea that we're by euphemizing them, we're paying them the tribute they've always demanded.
Yes. I'll give you some examples just because I realized that you'd asked me to give you examples of how it's still living, but like they're kind of liminal spaces. So these kind of in-between spaces in the land where, you know, you would find a highly productive field full of kind of cattle or full of kind of like potatoes or wheat and then or rapeseed oil kind of plants. But they would still be a ferry fort in the middle, even though it would be far more productive for the landscape to just destroy it. And there's very little legislation. The protection for them is actually dreadful from the state's perspective. But they still remain. And the belief is live. Like there's an example of Sean... Of Quinsworth. So the owner of Quinsworth, he found a Neolithic tomb on a site that he wanted to build a series of supermarkets. And he dug up the Neolithic tomb and brought it to his house and put it in his garden, which was obviously a terrible idea because then the Quinsworth Empire collapsed.
A direct correlation. This is what happens.
Direct. Absolutely direct.
This is what happens. You'll have bad cess if you mess with the good people.
Yeah, and see, it's all kind of tongue-in-cheek. You know, I think that kind of Irish absurdism works quite well. You know, like, it's not that people truly believe in the fairies. It's just that they're saying that they, you know, just, you know, they're keeping their options open. And And another one is the Hill of Tara, so which is actually quite a tragic story. So the Hill of Tara obviously is a incredibly rare and, you know, hugely significant from an Irish and Western European kind of perspective, this complex of beautiful kind of forts, all thousands and thousands of years old, the seat of the High Kings and Queens of Ireland. And basically the Irish government entered into a private, public-private contract with a motorway company, which was invested in by billions by kind of foreign multinational investors. And they decided to build the motorway anyway, even though I think it cost maybe max 40, 30 minutes, not even off the travel time for people into the city. And they built it anyway, despite huge opposition. And the once there was like a huge, a big kind of united cross-society collaboration between, you know, your old school hippies who believed that they needed to protect this site because it's a living site as well in terms of pagan worship. And also every year, this year even, we watched it all on the remotely as well, the light coming in through the window in Newgrange. Yes, because the government went through with that, that caused the economic crash. And and it also
caused...
But there was a load of like... I'll just read... I'm sorry now. I want you. I let you guys... I'll just read out a quick bit of the footnote here that we have in the book. The Tara M3 motorway project was ill-fated. So during the construction, the signatory of the order to destroy Lismullenhenge. So Lismullenhenge was this... was basically Stonehenge, but made of wood, that was destroyed for the motorway. It was found during the motorway project. So the Minister for the Environment, Dick Roach, like during very recently after he had signed for the destruction, he was held hostage by an armed gang in a hotel. And then Martin Cullen, the Minister for Transport, was in a helicopter accident. And then there was a number, two other accidents as well. The stairs in the National Museum collapsed very soon after. And then there was also two workers, so just kind of ordinary workers on the project, also were severely injured. So, yeah, I'm just saying.
I had no idea. I thought that like the environmental destruction and the damage to our archaeological heritage was the bad shit that happened to us as a country. But I didn't realize it was so real. Listen, when it comes to these fairy forts and these remnants of the other world that we've always cherished, what kind of place names do they tend to have? Because we've all seen a few around the country, like Lysafuca is down in County Kerry. There's lots of Cahars, lots of Dunes, lots of Raths around the country. Is there any particular one that refers more to fairy forts than, say, Neolithic man-made constructions?
No. So the word Rath is kind of a big one, and you hear that even Rathfarnham, Rathgar around Dublin as well. But they, I suppose, the vast majority would have a significance attached to them because of Irish mythology. Is kind of one place where it's pinpointed from. This is Eddie Lenihan, who was a kind of co-author on the book, along with Michael Holly and Askeaton Arts, published it. But the story goes that the Tuatha Dé Danann were kind of tricked by the Milesians or the Celts into taking the underworld. So they were told that they would get far more land if they kind of, you know, shared it with the kind of the Celtic invasion to Ireland. And the Tuatha Dé Danann were tricked into taking the underworld, which were kind of represented by these forts and sites in the landscape, the fairy forts. Mm-hmm. And they went underground and lived there. And they, so they're kind of, that's where the legend comes from. There's also another legend, which is that they were kind of during the battle of Lucifer and the angels against kind of the angel Gabriel, so the good and the bad angels, the kind of in-between angels fell to earth, and they went again and hidden these landscapes. But they throughout Irish
history... The centrist angels landed in Ireland.
But I think they were more Lucifer's kind of, you know, backers of it. And
they were the guys, they didn't fully support him. They're just, you got to hand it to him, you know?
Yes, yeah, I think that's it. And so that's another story. But yeah, so there are often places where, because they weren't consecrated ground, if you were an unbaptized child and you had been, you had died without a baptism, you weren't allowed to be buried on the consecrated ground of the Catholic Church. So many of these forts, fairy forts, actually became sites of for the burial of these people or children. So yeah, that's they kind of have that sort of liminal kind of sacred quality to them, and that respect is still living as well.
We'll be right back after this short message from another great Headstuff Podcast Network show. Spice Bags takes us into the magical mystical world of Irish foodstuffs and beyond.
Spice Bags is a podcast about food in Ireland from an international perspective. Hi, I'm May. I'm an American food writer, and I'm with my friends Blanca, a chef from Spain, and Dee, an Irish food editrix. And we are the Spice Bags, three sassy ladies with a lot to dish up. Join us for the chats.
Sinead, you're just saying there about some of these mounds being used as burial grounds for unbaptized children. When was that reversed? Or when was that changed?
I'm not quite sure. Certainly around the famine, particularly prior to the famine, people wouldn't really get there. There was a lot of marriages as well that would be outside the Catholic Church. A lot of children would have been born without being baptized. So I suppose maybe it would be relatively recent, because even in Connemara or on Ceathrúa, Tra Dolin there, the coral beach, there's still kind of a large kind of killing near the beach there, which would be kind of recent enough, I think.
Well, there's a well here. There's a Bridget's Well where I live in Clondalkin, and I can actually see it from my house. And it's supposed to have all the magical properties of a St. Bridget's Well. It's good for the eyes in particular. And there's a rag tree up there. But it was used well into the early 20th century as an unsanctified burial ground for unbaptized children. The idea being that if Mother Church wasn't going to look after the poor departed souls, then St. Bridget would. And that she'd steer them into the afterlife, and it's so amazing that belief system. Obviously, that belief system was well enshrined in Ireland. This idea that if the Catholic Church said no, you have to find a workaround. But I just think it's amazing that sort of pre-Christian heritage has lasted right the way through as well. Because we've spoken at length on this podcast about the link between Saint Bridget and any amount of pre-Christian goddesses that might be, I don't think contemporary is the word, but analogous to her. I suppose the question is, like, did the church not want to sort of take ownership of all of these fairy forts and ring forts and the likes in the way that they did the Holy Wells and many of the other sacred sites around the country?
I think that maybe it was kind of a point of shame for them, in one that they would have probably had to kind of acknowledge the fact that people, you know, I suppose that their children, the fact that you wouldn't, that an unbaptized child would be buried in this manner, might have been something a bit too difficult for the church to at the time to kind of reconcile with. But there are stories like that story there about the Lucifer's angels is an example of the church, I suppose, kind of rewriting what is in a very kind of old myth to kind of fit the biblical context. And you get that as well. You might have covered this, I'm sure, already. Unfortunately, I haven't listened to your entire back catalogue, Darragh, I'm very sorry. But
Shocking behaviour.
Shame. Boo. How did you get on?
I thought we had a vetting process.
Yeah, it seems to have failed. We'll have to sack the producer who recommended you so much.
I'm so sorry. After I bought him tea, but but the there's kind of a good there's a track record of this happening. So one thing I find very interesting is the story of Deirdre. So the Deirdre myth. So the Deirdre myth was kind of. Now, I'm very sorry. I have to find the name of the academic who wrote the original couple of articles on this. I know they were based in NUIG Galway. But that was originally kind of this fascinating study of what kingship should be. So what is the role of a king? Should they try and control their subjects? Should they try and kind of manage the way, like micromanage them and basically, or try and assert their own kind of ego over the populace? Or should they have an idea that is more kind of allow the subjects, or that they are not actually subjects, that your role is more of a mediator? So the Deirdre of the Sorrows myth is basically kind of based on Trojan Helen of Troy, this beautiful woman that brought about the destruction of, you know, these three brothers and her love, and brought about the destruction of the kingdom as well. The fated battle, I think, between Cú Chulainn and is it Cú Chulainn and Fiachar? Is that the two that fought the death?
It was Cú Chulainn and
Fiachar.
Yes, and Ferdia, sorry.
I mean, Cú Chulainn probably killed some sham called Fiachar as well. He killed a lot of people. One or two Fiachars. He killed a lot of cunns.
a right pack of cunns, all right.
All right, careful now.
But in the, yes, so in the story, I'm getting distracted with the crack. I was like, there's very, very little of it done during lockdown. But I was like,
Deirdre the Sorrows, yeah.
Deirdre the Sorrows, sorry, we're supposed to be crying. So Deirdre brought about the destruction of, basically the king at the time, the brothers as well. So, but because she was too beautiful, and this is a kind of a motto for women, you know, don't be too beautiful, and also try and be really pious, but don't be too pious. You know, all this kind of like sacred and profane. Yeah. The woman is kind of on a pedestal, or either something profane that destroys, everything. Women are the like Eve, I suppose. Eve brought about the downfall of man and cast him out of the garden. So that was kind of the rewritten, because a lot of these myths were written down by monks, which is brilliant and, you know, fair play to them, but they rewrote them kind of in a biblical context, you know, because they wanted to assimilate the pre-Christian culture into their own in a peaceful manner, which I suppose is great as well. But
we end up with a very bowdlerized version of a lot of the myths, you know, like, and how the myths are full of women leading heroes astray, and a woman is the reason for Cú Chulainn's death, and a woman was the reason for Fionn Mac Cuaill losing control and going mad in his old age, and a woman was the reason Oisin was led astray, and a woman was the reason the kingdom of Ulster ultimately came to nothing. And it's like, Jesus, lads. I mean, this was obviously transcribed by celibate men with an awful lot of sexual frustration. I think it's very, very clear that the monks who are writing this down had major issues, societal issues, patriarchal issues. I think it's...
Yeah,
it's,
I mean, look at those round obvious towers. That's pretty Freudian stuff.
Wonderful friend called Michelle Russell. So her artist name is Mice Hell, and she's doing a costume kind of history of Irish culture. So she's going literally back to Neolithic, pre kind of the time of Newgrange and before, and kind of charting what people would have worn, like doing kind of meticulous research. And she was saying, I'm paraphrasing what she's told me, but she said that most of those monks, first of all, were not celibate, and they were extremely violent. there was huge feuds between different, like, you know, the kind of, these monasteries were basically towns in the day, so there'd be kind of battles between the different monks over different things, and then you had, this is the interesting thing with Saint Bridget, because she was a very powerful woman as well, and a very powerful abbess that kind of had control of a large quantity of land and had an awful lot of kind of followers. So I suppose partly what some of the writing obviously must be structured with power as well, that they didn't want further more of these women, I suppose, didn't want to share the power, and probably kind of wrote all these stories to you know, dear Miss Bridget, who do you think you are? You're going to destroy everything, which is interesting because why isn't she more of a celebrated saint? Her name, Brigid, is like the, you know, the Mary of the Irish, like basically our Mary Immaculate figure. And yet she's not kind of considered a full sort of on the same level as St. Patrick. You know?
We don't even get a bank holiday.
I know, we should get a bank holiday. That was actually my first piece of legislation for the Green Party.
Still hasn't happened. Listen, it's a campaign promise I can get behind simply because we need a bank holiday between Christmas and St. Patrick's Day.
Would you not rather a bank holiday in July?
No. We get one in June and we get one in August and we get one in May.
You'd have a great run. You'd have a great run, but you don't need a bank holiday right after Christmas and everyone's broke.
Ah, you do. You need a day off, man. After January, you need a day off. I need a day off after January.
One of the big issues has been that most of Ireland's kind of, I guess national days or saints' days are in the wrong part of the year. They're in the depths of winter, spring, or early wet spring. And
there's none in early wet spring. All we get St. Patrick's Day, which can be snowing on St. Patrick's Day, mm-hmm. and we get Easter, which is a movable feast. Mm-hmm. It can be as late as May. But yeah, we get nothing in January and February. I'd love a day off in February. I'd love a day off in February. It's a short month, gets even shorter when you have a Monday off.
I'm reading some interesting stuff with Sylvia Federici and also this brilliant book, Mehel by Anne O'Dowd. And just this idea that medieval times were far tougher, and I'm sure obviously from a healthcare perspective they were, but also...
I argued the toss on that one.
But you did have an awful lot of holidays because the agricultural year, you'd be extremely busy during the summer and the kind of planting and the harvesting season. But then, you know, like there was a huge amount of bank holidays kind of festivals and more free time in a way than perhaps you know what you'd have in a kind of more Americanized kind of work culture. So the concept of rest and time was quite different then, and that's something kind of often forgotten or kind of not really looked at in terms of peasant life.
Yeah, the idea that total productivity is something that needs to be aimed for it has just gone completely unquestioned. The idea that people are supposed to, you know, be obsessed with their jobs as opposed to, you know, well, I guess their entire kind of role in society and in their families and in those things, that the idea that you should pick a job you love and just constantly do it, and that this has been run parallel with the erosion of workers' rights. It's a damn shame.
Yeah, I just want to bring back Beltane and Lunasa and Imolc and Samhain as mass outbreaks of debauchery, basically. treat them in the way a holiday really should be treated, you know? I want to, yeah, definitely give me the extra bank holiday at the 1st of February, but let's also throw in a bunch of bonfires and naked dancing and, you know, animal sacrifices if necessary. I'm not down with that myself, but, you know, if you want to do it, that's fine.
Think pieces about naked dancing and animal sacrifices?
You don't read them, like, you know? just take your clothes off and dance. Go with it.
There's loads of there's Mardi Gras, there's like the, you know, the Carnival in the Caribbean. Like, there's loads of these festivals. We kind of have Christmas and maybe St. Patrick's Day, but like we should really have, there should definitely be a massive one before Lent, you know, like what? I don't know what the church is doing. Like, why doesn't it, why can't it just talk about the holidays? Then people will go back to it.
I think in the South American church, that's the big thing. Like, carnival literally means a goodbye to meat. It's a party you have before Lent.
Yeah,
and I think
it's big in Germany too.
And yeah, they like it. You find even the countries that finish the sign of the cross with a little kiss, with a little chef's kiss, they have a very different attitude to Catholicism than Irish people do.
Yeah. Pasta Catholicism seems a bit more enjoyable than potato Catholicism.
I would pick pasta Catholicism or potato Catholicism any day of the week.
Maybe Pope Francis will bring it back.
He knows, he's an Argentinian. Yeah, he's got that Latin flair, maybe. Who knows?
Obviously, the women thing needs to be.
I mean,
yeah, as far as popes go. Yeah. The whole women thing. And yeah. He came out Oh, sure. Look, we could talk all day about that one. The women and the priests.
But I want to go back to. Let's do what the Catholic Church have done for centuries and put women to one side for this. And let's get back to fairy forts. Because look, they're not just a part of our topographical landscape and our history now, but they've also become a massive tourist draw as well. And you know, this idea, this fairy heritage, it's where buses stop. And I'm thinking in particular, I've read loads of reviews of this amazing spiritual fairy fort in Ballyalaban in North Clare. And that, like, buses from Galway will go there and they'll all just, they'll get off the N67 and cartloads of tourists will head down and see this very well preserved earthen ring fort, which they are absolutely told, hook, line and sinker, it's a fairy fort. I mean, is it in the first instance? You said there's a difference between ring forts and fairy forts. Not every ring fort is a fairy fort. And are we doing a disservice to the good people by allowing cartloads of people, both foreign and domestic, to tramp all over their sacred spaces?
Yeah, so this is something interesting I covered in the book as well. Like, I find this fascinating in the Irish kind of like mindset. So so I discussed this, the heritageization of nature, and the kind of the fact that, like, the state won't really allow kind of the... So how I viewed it was that you, like, Brian Friel's translations. So you have that play is about kind of this Irish language community that has to come to terms with the Ordnance Survey and the rewriting of all the landscape around them in basically the words of the oppressor. So you have kind of English, and, you know, not always, like, there were some wonderful folklorists. Actually, John Creedon has done a really good kind of series of documentaries on kind of very good people who were just trying to preserve things, and they did preserve a lot of it in their writings. But fundamentally, it was kind of a military project, basically a colonial project of rewriting the Irish landscape in the language of the oppressor. And the even if they did get wonderful kind of descriptions from the folklorists or kind of geographers that were employed, the English state couldn't be bothered and just wrote down, you know, what it sounded like. So you get, like, you know, on one place in Connemara is Mwikinioch Idir Dahalia. So it's like the pig-shaped hill in between two sails, which has, like, a very kind of interesting, you know, kind of obviously the kind of seafaring kind of legend and that kind of aspect of the area. But it's translated into this absolutely meaningless kind of big long word, Mwikinioch, I can't even pronounce it. And Carro is the same. Carro means nothing. Yeah, but that's what it is in Irish, but the English version means nothing. Clonmel is another good example, and I'm sure you have discussed this already, but it means the honey meadow in Irish, but Clonmel is meaningless, and that's effectively what the Ordnance Survey kind of did in the vast majority of cases. And how I saw law in this context, or environmental law, is that environmental law is not there to preserve the environment as its fundamental like raison d'etre. That's not what it was created to do. It was created to maintain just enough nature, like, in capital N, I'm doing the finger thing, you can't see me, but just enough nature to allow to regenerate itself so colonialism or extraction could occur on top of it. It's like sustainable development in its very kind of thinnest form. And what environmental law does is that it rewrites the world and the landscape around it in the language that is understood by the oppressor. So land becomes completely disconnected from how the people in the region kind of see that land, or the spiritual connections to it, the, like, even the biodiversity properties. That's a very new phenomenon from the 80s and 70s onwards, and even then it only really exists in very narrow contexts where you mitigate the impact on the environment. You don't try to preserve, like, kind of the environment itself as a whole for its own sake, you know. And what so law kind of sees it as just land, as a kind of bundle of property rights, completely extracted from the vision of the land itself, like in and of itself. And what kind of the state does is that it has this type of kind of exploitative regime of land law, and kind of which is mitigated a little bit kind of by, you know, kind of birds directives or habitats directives from mainly from the EU. And then it has this kind of heritage regime, which is like the nature for the kind of the idolatry of the state, or for the vision of the state's vision of itself. So it protects sites that, like, you know, like where Michael Davitt is from, or like there are like numerous petrol stations for American presidents.
I frankly, I can't wait to see who wins the battle for the Joe Biden Plaza. It's either going to be in Carlingford or Claire Morris.
And like you have, yeah, so you have these sites that are protected for like the state's vision of itself. So Connemara National Park, or like Millennium Park, or, and I'm not saying that this is a bad form, but it's important to unpick why the state is protecting these sites and not others. Why is the Hill of Allen, which is where St. Bridget is from, why is half of that mined, basically, an open pit, like quarry, while Crowpatrick, which is full of gold, by the way, isn't touched at all. Like, what does that say about the prioritization of natural context? Why was the west coast of Mayo, a beautiful kind of landscape, Irish language community, intensely kind of connected to the landscape? And I'm not, like, there's obviously, we'll go into the kind of blood soil kind of stuff, which is really dodgy, and that's bad. But but there's like, but in terms, like, trying to kind of find that kind of obviously welcoming concept of landscape and nature that's also inclusive, but also gives nature kind of a protection in and of itself, and in terms of the how the community views it. Why was that kind of area allowed to be like destroyed and subject to gas flaring to facilitate Shell? Where does the prioritization of capital and the protection of capital by the state, when that clashes with heritage is just bulldozed, literally bulldozed. Like, that's what happened in Tara. Like, you couldn't get a site more important to the Irish concept of itself from a heritage perspective. Even like if you were going to like take kind of a little bit of the tourist edge of it, that kind of selling of ourselves to Americans, like none of that could stand in the way of capital kind of accumulation. And
but that doesn't change, and that's universal. That's not just an Irish thing. I mean, there's an ongoing battle to try and save Stonehenge from the building of a large road and even a proposed tunnel underneath it. Like, this idea of tunneling close to one of the oldest and most important heritage sites on these islands, it seems pure dodge. Like, it just seems like a really stupid idea. And yet, yeah, capital is untouched. Like, we've got lovely places. We can point to amazing places, like, you know, oh, isn't the Burren incredible? And isn't the Burren a remarkable feature of the Irish landscape? And it's like, it's easy to preserve the Burren. You can't fucking build on it.
And I think the fact that Crowpatrick, as you say, I mean, like, there was no gold in Tara that we know of, and then there was no gold in Underwood Quay, but like for some reason Crowpatrick did survive. It probably was because of its connection to religious belief.
Yes, and it's there's other, like, Michelle Harrigan kind of she was the brilliant editor on Men Who Read Ringforts. She did a very interesting artistic project based on kind of this idea, the heritageization, or the kind of kitsch, that's what's happening with the fairy forts, not in all contexts. Like, I think it's wonderful that these people, obviously, kind of I think it's very sad and wonderful that these people who have had to emigrate because of poverty and are now trying to come back and reestablish that connection. And there's something kind of very sad there, and that should be kind of welcomed. I'm not giving out about any American person that is seeking to reconnect. That's not the problem at all. But the problem, I suppose, is the kind of that tongue-in-cheek, do we believe in fairies or do we not? She did a very interesting art project called Where Does the Law Stand with Leprechauns? And she looked at this site near her in Limerick where these two children came down, kind of, I think, connected to that whole kind of moral panic about the visions of the Virgin Mary. Do you remember the Bannspittle, the crying Mary of Bannspittle and so on? And these two children came down from the mountains and said, the moving statues. They said that they had seen leprechauns on the hill. And everyone was like, oh, you didn't see leprechauns at all. What are you on about? And then, but then one of a couple of the local people were like, maybe they did see leprechauns. We can make money out of this.
I think yeah, where you can make a few bob out of it, you've every that's what we have to do. That's how we save all the fairy forts. Literally just say you've seen the fairies and charge people. Well, then we can preserve the whole country if we just start charging people for access.
Yes, commercialise our very beans.
That's what we'll do, yeah. We'll all be like, this is it. Basically, yes, brilliant. Goldstone Shave wanted to put a wall around old Donegal with casinos and chicken ranches and all that. Maybe if we just do that, let's nationalise the country and start charging people for it. I think we'll no. live. Brilliant,
No, but what I was trying to say was that the fairy forts kind of are this, they're sort of, if you look at, you know, Tron, like the movie Tron, like, so the Lost Tape is like this huge big grid that's kind of covered the landscape in like a falsified kind of idea of what it should be for the capitalist kind of modernity of the state. What the fairy forts are literally these kind of black holes. And the state doesn't know how to cope with them because that belief of the fairy is real. You can't entirely commercialise it because some of the sites are good for tourists and some of the sites are good for kind of the heritage idea of the state. But some of them are just kind of like these weird lumps. And some of them are fairy trees, which, you know, like they don't really work that way, or they might be out of the way kind of holy wells. So they kind of are spaces of resistance, I think, or a different way of seeing the world. And that's what they need to kind of be celebrated as. So, yeah. They're a way out, you know, of Tron.
A way out of Tron.
A way out of Tron.
Before we wrap up, Sinead, we'd like to ask all our guests what their favourite Irish word is.
My favourite Irish word? Oh, wow. There's a lot. You really should have my dad here and my mom. Rather myself, my dad's always he's some wonderful phrases. One I like a lot is Hanse Anir Duruam. Hanse Anir Duruam. So that's when he came like the northeast wind upon me. So he spooked me. He's like, oh, because it's a really fantastic. Horrible wind, very cold. Yeah. And then there's another one. I love Clopolis, and then I like, which is like the half light, the gloaming, the twilight, and then I like Cohiel. So that's the one that's most fitting, I think, here, because Timpelucht means surrounding, so it's very close to the Irish word, sorry, the English word, which means environs us, separate from us, circles the human who is not part of nature. But Cohiel means the lived-in life, and it's much more similar to bon vivre, or like these conceptions of, in kind of more indigenous cultures, particularly in South and Central America, where nature is like the lived-in life. So, yeah, Cohiel. I suppose.
Cohiel. Love it. When I was in primary school, that's what we called environmental studies when I was in primary school, when I was in the girls' school. It was Aulus Cohiel.
That's why you're so sound, Peter.
Oh, you'll be back. Oh, you'll be back. Yeah, that's, we're getting her back on. Sinead, it's been absolutely brilliant to have you on the show. We've barely scratched the surface of this ring fort full of fairies, to coin a phrase. But the book is called Men Who Eat Ring Forts, and it was funded by
Clare County Council, their Gaining Ground Arts Programme. So thank you very much to Clare County Council.
Clare is chock full of ring forts, of course.
Yes, it is actually. Yes, yeah. There's another great book called The Dream Time of County Clare. The name of the author escapes me, but it's another brilliant book.
Sinead, thank you so much for joining us. And in the meantime, it's a slán from me.
Agus slán wimse.
Slán.
Mind yourselves. Hey, Dara again. Thank you so much for listening to today's episode. Motherfucker comes out every week on the Head Stuff Podcast Network. Thanks to Brian for producing. Thanks to Kirsten Shield for doing the art. We record our podcast on remotely.fm. If you ever wanted to make your own podcast, we recommend it. Check out the link in our show notes. Until the next time, mind yourselves. See you next week.
This has been a production of the Head Stuff Podcast Network.
Every time you've ever sent a gift, I'm just wondering, what did you not put in? What did you keep for yourself now?
press the start recording button so that Brian has an outtake or something to shtick in at the end, which, you know, lightens the mood.